Hello and welcome to the special edition of Midori House here on Monocle 24, coming to you live from Zurich with me, Tyler Brulé, and Andrew Tuck.
Coming up in the next 60 minutes, we'll talk economics in the franc with Gerhard Schwarz, the director of the think tank Avenir Suisse.
And if you're looking for tips on how to make the best espresso, skip the cute barista around the corner. Instead, try the head of analytical and physical chemistry at the Zurich University of Applied Sciences. He runs a course called The Art and Science of Coffee, and we met up with him earlier today at a cafe in Niederdorf.
The difficult elements in a good espresso, besides of course selecting the coffee, is the grinding and then also the freshness of the coffee.
Also ahead, Felix Messmer, the owner of Zurich's Wohnbedarf, perhaps one of the most respected furniture stores in the world, will join us in the studio. We'll talk about the basics of good Swiss design.
And we'll hear from some friendly food and drink vendors from the IM Viaduct Markthalle, a food market in the city's west.
We have different regions there. Fougères, South France, Corbière Minerois, a selection of Beaujolais and the Valley of Loire. It's very famous.
And a bit later, Freck Frabosa from the Swiss Consumer Institute, GDI, will join us for a primer on what lies ahead.
Plus, we'll hear a local song or two. All that and much more coming up over the next hour right here on Midori House, live on Monocle 24. But before all that, it's time to head back to London to James Luckhurst with the hour's headlines.
Monocle 24 News. A US Senate committee investigating money laundering claims at HSBC says the bank provided a conduit for drug kingpins and rogue nations. The report said suspicious funds from countries including Mexico, Iran and Syria had passed through the bank. The committee has been hearing from HSBC officials, one of whom said he found it painful and embarrassing to talk about the bank's shortcomings. HSBC's head of group compliance, David Bagley, took the hearing as an opportunity to step down from his role. Activists in Syria say fighting is intensifying around the capital, Damascus. According to the unconfirmed reports, there's been shooting in one of the main central streets and a square housing the central bank. There were also reports of tanks in a southwestern suburb and clashes involving helicopters in the north and northeast of the city. Meanwhile, the UN Special Envoy Kofi Annan has held talks with Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov. Afterwards, Mr. Annan said he was hopeful of finding a solution to suit all parties on the issue of a Security Council resolution, something Russia has so far made clear it will not support.
Obviously, the discussions in the Security Council regarding the resolution also came up, and I would hope that the Council will continue its discussions and hopefully find a language that will pull everybody together for us to move forward on this critical issue.
The British Foreign Secretary, William Hague, has said more sanctions would be enforced against Iran if no progress is achieved on Tehran's nuclear program. Iran denies Western accusations of a covert agenda to develop a nuclear weapon, insisting it wants to stockpile enriched uranium solely to generate more electricity for a rapidly growing population, as well as radioisotopes for medical use. Mr. Hague said more sanctions would be enforced against Tehran if no diplomatic progress were achieved.
We have brought into force very wide-ranging sanctions on Iran. Without progress in these negotiations, we will intensify those sanctions in the months ahead. We are determined to prevent nuclear proliferation in the Middle East, and the Iranians should not doubt our resolve in our determination to prevent that coming about.
Indian fishermen who survived a gun attack by a US Navy boat off the coast of the United Arab Emirates have disputed claims by the US that they had ignored warnings to steer clear of the vessel. One Indian was killed and three others injured when the USNS Rappahannock, a refueling ship, fired on the fishing vessel. Officials from the US Navy said the fishing boat had approached at high speed and ignored repeated warnings. The European Commission, which controls one of the world's largest science budgets, has backed calls for free access to publicly funded research in a move that could force a major change in the business model for publishers such as Reed Elsevier. The Commission said on Tuesday that open access will be a general principle applied to grants awarded through the €80 billion Horizon 2020 programme for research and innovation. And those are the top stories here at Monocle 24.
Thanks very much for that, James. It is just 19.05 here in Zurich, 18.05 in London. You're listening to Midori House with Tyler Brulé and Andrew Tuck. Hello, Mr. Tuck.
Hello, how are you?
I'm very well.
I know how well you are, actually, because we've had a very good day.
Zurich has been very good to us for the last 72 hours.
It's involved a lot of water today, though.
Yeah, a lot of water, a lot of sunshine. I'm happy to report, and I can still see. It's actually nice having a studio where you're not sort of cloistered, within sort of just carpeted walls. But I think you've got a better vantage point from where you're sitting, but it is still very sunny. I think that the clouds pretty much lifted this morning. We started the day in, I think, sort of best foot forward when it comes to quality of life. We had a nice 30-minute run this morning down the lake, and then we went to Badi Utoke, which is not too far from where we're staying, and had a fantastic morning of reading daily papers, drinking nice coffee, and having a dip in the lake.
It was amazing to be, I was a bit scared diving into that lake because you did go in off the big board, but I kind of gingerly went in down the stairs, but it wasn't too cold. It was so extraordinary to be at 8:30 in the morning having breakfast outside on the deck, taking a bit of sunshine, reading the papers, as you say, and getting ready for the day.
Yeah, and feeling that you were very much on top of the world and you were in on a secret a lot of people are not party to.
And I think anybody who questions, why Zurich won the Quality of Life Survey, they should just come and see the bathing culture here in this city is amazing.
It's that sense, and oftentimes when you do speak to people from Zurich, they say that holidays are maybe taken in the autumn if you want to take your 2 or 3 weeks off, or some other point, at some other point across the year, because summers, when it does hit this city, it is incredible. You really don't have to leave. And I think as you referenced this morning, just looking at the office buildings not too far from Utoke, thinking, God, you would definitely want to be a worker where you're only steps away from going to a great bathing club. But we were also good to ourselves at lunchtime as well, because we went to the renovated Oberletten and Unterletten, the Fluss Bad that they have there, which is a swimming club in the river. And again, you just cannot believe the level of public investment just the infrastructure for what is a public park. Of course, some things are leased out for other people to operate. In this case, Panama, which is the cafe operator there, just a really exceptional experience.
And amazing, the kind of public contract as well. We saw people coming up on their bicycles, not bothering to lock them, just kind of pushing them into the bike rack. There was books that you could borrow for free to read while you sat on the free sun lounges, which were amazing. That every kind of bit of that facility was well cared for. And it was because people looked after it. People cherished that there was this amazing resource for the whole city.
Well, I think we've probably made everyone sufficiently envious at this point. In a moment, we're going to talk more about, of course, how does this economy stay so buoyant, and how is there such a strong social contract? We're going to be talking to Gerhard Schwarz from Avenir Swiss, the think tank. You're listening to Midori House. We're back in a moment.
From London, this is Monocle 24.
London is New York, is Hong Kong, is the Tokyo. Sie sind Monocle 24.
Aus London, das ist Monocle 24.
Από το Λονδίνο, αυτό είναι το Monocle 24.
Вы слушаете Monocle 24.
Λόντοστε καζίν, τämä on Monocle 24.
London Bowl, as a Monocle 24.
Λόντζοδα, βουρεσε Monocle 24.
Λόντενιστ, σύνο Monocle 24.
De Londres, essa é a Monocle 24.
O que você está ouvindo é Monocle 24.
Isso é o Monocle 24.
Você escuta Monocle 24.
Das ist Monocle 24.
Du lyssnar på Monocle 24.
Kuuntelet Monocle 24.
Viestes Monocle 24.
Esto es Monocle 24.
Detta är Monocle 24.
En Monocle 24 talbacka. Yeah.
And you are back with Midori House with Tyler Brulé and Andrew Tuck, 19.09 in Zurich. It is 13.09 if you are listening in New York. Well, each day brings another bleak assessment of the future of the Eurozone, with the crisis deepening and the future of the euro at risk. We thought we'd take a look at the status of a loan economy quietly getting on with its own mayhem.
Of course, the Swiss economy is known for its resilience, due in part to its educated and skilled workforce, efficiency and the strength of its banking sector. The country's unemployment rate last month was 2.7%. Compare that to Spain, which saw almost a quarter of its population without a job in April, or even a country like Sweden, which had 7% unemployment rate in the same period.
I should correct what I was saying earlier. It's actually sustaining itself and staying away from the mayhem. The big question, of course, is can it be sustained, or will the economic chaos around the Alpine Oasis eventually bring it down as well? Well, joining us in the studio is Gerhard Schwarz, the director of the independent think tank Avenir Swiss. Welcome. Before we went on air, we were talking about the state of an economy right now, which is, you know, continues to do well. I mean, when you look at a number like 2.7% unemployment, that's almost zero unemployment. Does it continue to sustain itself, you know, at a time when the banks are clearly having to do a lot of soul searching in this country right now? Many of them been, you know, thumped, you know, not just on the local stage, but on the world stage. Where do you see things going when you look into your crystal ball at the think tank?
Well, we are not a prognosis institute, but a think tank. But of course, we hope that it is sustainable. On the other hand, we all realize that we are an island, and if you have a storm around you, then of course the island is also affected. And therefore, I am worried because all the problems of Europe are at the end also problems of Switzerland. But a little bit in another way, because we have very high migration, we have a very strong Swiss franc. So it's more or less the failure of success, or the problems of success, which we will have to fight in the future.
And Gerhard, what lies at the kind of the core of the strength of Switzerland as an economy? When we look north to Germany, we often reference, you know, the Mittelstand there, and that seems to be why they've done well. Is it something similar here in Switzerland? Lots of smaller companies with very good specialisms. Is that why Switzerland's done well?
Well, that's part of the explanation, but I would say even more important is that we had a very good economic policy, or very good is perhaps exaggerated, but we are just doing better than the others, or the others do worse. And I would also say that the stability of the country is probably one of the main reasons. A long time I was myself critical of our political system, where you actually don't have any opposition, you don't have any change in the government. But by hindsight, I would say that's one of the real strong points of Switzerland, that you have the same government since the 50s, with the same parties, actually no change. And that's what investors like. They want to have stability.
As Andrew was referencing, we were talking a little bit earlier, Gerhard, it was quite incredible, you know, being at this body earlier today and just seeing people ride up on their bicycles and just leaving them. No locking up, and off they go, bicycles not even in sight. And so there's this incredible social capital that exists in the country. And despite also, you know, we've seen, you know, waves of inward migration as well. Social capital, of course, leads to you know, stability as well. How is that maintained? And I think how does that also transfer itself into the business sector?
Well, I think one of the reasons, without being too nostalgic, is that, of course, Switzerland doesn't have really big cities. Even Zurich is not a huge city. It might be an important center, but it's not a huge city. And a lot of people live in the outskirts, in comparatively small villages. Then the political system with direct democracy, where you really care also for the political side. You know, it's not the state is there, it's we are the state. And that, I think, is a mentality which goes through the whole society and also shows up then in a behavior like the one mentioned by you.
Mm. Can I ask you, the question of migration is interesting. Most economies around Europe, they have a kind of a difficult relationship with migration. They socially, it may be difficult for the country to absorb these people, and they become political problems. But the economists always think, actually, the more migration in the end you have, the better you need to grow your economy. These people often hardworking, they come in at the bottom of the pyramid and they help boost the economy. The Swiss kind of view of migration is very complicated. Do you think that in the future Switzerland is going to have to open up more to migration, or do you think it's going to you know, as you say, you're the political right here, trying to close it down a bit?
Well, first of all, you have to realize that Switzerland is probably one of the most open countries, not only in Europe, but in the world. I mean, we have, 27% or so of the population has been born outside the country. So that's one of the highest rates you can imagine. And I think from that point of view, we had, especially in the last few years, we had a very strong migration, not in absolute terms, but in relative terms, which really matters. And therefore, I think migration will be a problem, not only for the right-wing parties, but you realize now that also in the political middle segment of society, you have you get problems with migration. But Switzerland, of course, got rich by many foreigners. I myself was born in Austria, so I'm a typical example. But of course, a lot of entrepreneurs in the 19th century came from abroad. And also in the 20th century, you had a lot of foreigners which were important for the development of the economy as entrepreneurs, as scientists in research and so on.
What do you think the path is, Gerhard, for this country to maintain its position? Because banking secrecy is gone. Many of the hallmarks that have really defined Switzerland in so many ways, they're simply not there anymore. Of course, many of the cantons now work incredibly hard to attract, if not regional, but also global headquarters. You know, a massive battle going on between Geneva and Zurich. Is that part of the path? Because Switzerland has always been associated with being incredibly, you know, international on a world stage. And it's interesting how you said, you know, Zurich may not be a big city, but it is, it's certainly important as a global hub. How does it stay relevant? How does Switzerland stay relevant?
Well, first of all, I hope that banking still will be an important factor of our economy. I would say, even if bank secrecy is gone, privacy will be a value. And I think Switzerland should take care of that value, because privacy is, for me, actually a human right. And a lot of people want privacy, not only for tax reasons. There are many other reasons why privacy, also in financial matters, is important. I think international centers, yes, can be a pass into the future. We see that now, for example, in all these trading companies for raw materials, for oil and so on, which have their headquarters or their European centers, at least in Switzerland. I think also the whole medical sector is an important element and can be an important factor for the wealth of the future.
Can I also ask you about the wealth, you know, that kind of idea of the wealth of the future? How important is it that when people turn over a product or they look at a box, it says made in Switzerland? You know, how much capital does that carry when you make a product? Does it, do you think it allows you to add a little bit extra to your price because people do see that made in Switzerland, and it has a value perhaps more than any other European country?
I'm not so sure that it's really that much stronger than in other countries. I mean, by British or made in Germany, these also were brands.
We don't make anything
brands,
in England anymore. Germany, maybe.
Okay. I'm not sure that that's really much stronger in Switzerland than in other countries. But of course, a small country has to have a very peculiar balance between protectionism on one side and taking care of your own identity and being open on the other hand. And I think that's also true in this buying behavior. I mean, a lot of people nowadays go to Germany or to France to buy food and whatever they find much cheaper there because of the strong Swiss franc. So I wouldn't say that, the buying behavior here is more protectionist than anywhere else. But of course, a small country has perhaps even more patriotic emotion also in the economic sector.
I mean, just before we go, I wanted to ask, I'm always amazed that you can still come across companies which, you know, would maybe be, you know, defined as sort of the Swiss Mittelstand, you know, 100 person, 70 person companies, you know, that are still also able to trade, you know, make, you know, advanced products which should be on the world stage, but, you know, 98% of their sales are still in Switzerland. Andrew sort of referenced that point about, you know, Swiss quality and made in Switzerland. You know, from one city to another village, is it still important for people to also support the home team here, do you think, as well?
Yeah, of course. When I lived for about 25 years in a comparatively small village, and of course there is this attitude, okay, I don't go to the big shopping center, I buy in the village because I know the people there. And of course, also because you have this autonomy of the villages also in tax matters. So at the end, you also profit as a citizen of this village if the village is doing economically well, because then the taxes are paid there. And that means that at the end, you have to pay less taxes. So there is also a direct interest, which you don't have in other countries.
Great. Gerhard Schwarz, director at the think tank Avenue Swiss. Thanks very much. Coming up, we're going to be hearing a little bit of music and also chat with someone who thinks the Swiss make the best baristas. Stay with Midori House.
Modern Thailand is on the move. Take transport. We're building urban mass transit systems and a $15.4 billion high-speed rail link that will crisscross the country faster than ever before. We've even developed a solar-powered prototype of our famous tuk-tuks for a greener urban journey. And if you think that sounds good, wait until you hear our homegrown teapot. To find out more, visit modern-thailand.com.
Wherever you're going this summer, and whether it's for work or play, let Monocle's editors be your travel companions. We've just refreshed and revised our team's guides to the world's top business cities and resorts, so you can have our 25-25 travel guide series in the palm of your hand with the Monocle app, available from iTunes, or download free guides from monocle.com. From São Paulo to New York, Capri to St. Bart's, we can show you where to long lunch or go for your morning run. Just head to the iTunes App Store and download the Monocle app. Monocle, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
It's 1922 here in Zurich, 1823 now, if you are listening in London. This is Midori House with Tyler Brulé and Andrew Tuck. Do you feel like a song?
I wouldn't mind a song. Something Swiss?
Why don't we have something Swiss? This is, it's appropriately, it's called Master Plan. They're very good at planning in this country, as we've noted. I think it was interesting when you talked to Gerhard, you know, the notion of sort of, you know, what and we mentioned it several times today, you know, what is a, seems to be sort of, you know, a problem and a hurdle in this country is would be sort of laughable in many other parts of the world as well.
Incredible.
This is a Master Plan by Stephanie Heinzmann.
That was Master Plan, even by Stephanie Heinzmann, who hails from Visp in the canton of Valais.
Now, I'm going to turn our attention to, well, it would have been more of a theme for this morning when we were enjoying several coffees on the lake. But anyway, Shahan Yuritsian was once just a coffee consumer, but after postdoctorates at UCLA in Munich and landing a job at Nestle in Lausanne, all that changed. Nestle asked what product he'd like to work on, and on a whim, he chose coffee. He entered a special research group on coffee aroma in 1995, leaving behind the world of amateur coffee appreciation to enter the realm of the specialist.
He's now a professor in analytical chemistry in Zurich and teaches a post-grad degree in coffee. It's a 26-day course. Monocle's Daniel Giacopelli met him at the Henrici Cafe in the city's Niederdorf district. Over espresso, they chatted about the countries with the best baristas, and we asked him
which the ultimate cup of coffee was he'd ever had.
First of all, baristas in Switzerland are relatively good. I think they are world's best baristas, it's my feeling. And I know also in UK you have excellent baristas, so they're doing actually a lot of things right. The difficult elements in a good espresso, besides of course selecting the coffee, which is done quite well, is the grinding and then also the freshness of the coffee. You know, so you have to be really careful the way you grind and you extract, the speed of you doing that, and then serving immediately. So I think today most baristas are doing good job. One element that is always critical is the hygiene and the cleanliness of the machines, because if you don't clean properly, you will have a degradation of the quality of the flavor, but also of the creamer. And that's something that is often neglected. So if you come to a place like here, you know, and Ricci, then you have always a well-maintained machine, but in 80-90% of the places, you don't have that. And that's the critical place where, of course, if you don't have a barista, a regular person, most people don't know how to extract. So there the problem is old coffee, not fresh coffee.
And why do you think Swiss baristas are among the world's best or the world's best?
Well, of course, they never win the world championship. So that would be like a sign they must not be among the best. There's never been a Swiss world barista champion. It's UK has been once very close. I don't know, UK first or second, US has been. Now recently also Central American have been winning, so Swiss never win. But if you look at the density of baristas, for example, or if you look at the density of certified baristas who can take the degree from others, you know, give a degree, so the highest density is by far in Switzerland. There's only one country who has more, that is Korea. And not only in relative to the number of people who live in Switzerland, but also in absolute terms. So in Switzerland, we have perhaps 30 certified barista trainers, barista trainers. And then in Germany, you have in absolute terms less, in Italy, in France. And then if you do it per inhabitant, it's a very big number in Switzerland. So we have a lot of expertise in different areas here.
Thank you.
Merci.
Right.
Okay.
What's the best cup of coffee you've ever had?
Wow, that's a difficult thing, you know. I can't tell you that, you know. Really, it's difficult to say. There are different places where you can have excellent coffees. You can do it yourself too, of course. We have excellent machines at the university. But I like a coffee that has little acidity, but some kind of a chocolatey cocoa note, and of course a strong aroma, smell. These are the things that I appreciate a lot. For me, the smell of a coffee is a very important thing before you drink it. And that's and you find it, for example, here, I think it's good. So I like a small acidity, not too strong, and this cocoa note is important. And also the roasty note is very important. A good roasty note, not a burnt note, the roasty note. And so if you have that, and you find that now regularly, and you can do it yourself. So where I got the best, I can't really tell you right now. Perhaps I know, now that you... Perhaps I got my best coffee in New York. I just have a very strong memory of a coffee I had on 7th Street. I forgot how it's called. It was a very small shop. You couldn't even sit. It was only like a window. He was serving coffee. He's a well-known guy. I guess that's my strongest memory of an excellent coffee right now, if you ask me.
Maybe today we'll beat that one.
Perhaps. I don't know. I haven't tasted it. So I should try now before it gets too old, you know?
Well, that was our producer, Daniel Giocopelli, chatting with Shahan Yuretsian, and we're going to be right back after this.
Interesting listening to that piece about coffee, and I'm not sure if it was a bit of a protectionist stance, because I often think that coffee in Switzerland, while it's a big trading market and it's home of Nespresso and lots of things, a lot of the coffee you get is automated, comes out of, you know, good machines, it's all right, but it's... Funnily enough, I never get the sense that we're that close to Italy.
No, we went to somewhere today that seemed to have quite good coffee.
Yeah, that was good.
I had quite nice coffee at Café Lang. But I do like the fact that he talked about the density of certified baristas in the world.
Yes, absolutely. Very important.
That's a map I'd like to see, I think.
Coming up in the next half hour, we're going to be talking to the owner of Von Bedorf, and we're also going to be doing a little tour around the Viaduct Markthalle, and we're going to speak to Frank Froberse from the Gottlieb Duttweiler Institute. But let's go back to London right now and check in with James Luckhurst for the bottom of the hour headlines.
A US Senate committee investigating money laundering claims at HSBC says the bank provided a conduit for drug kingpins and rogue nations. The report said suspicious funds from countries including Mexico, Iran and Syria had passed through the bank. Activists in Syria say fighting is intensifying around the capital, Damascus. According to the unconfirmed reports, there had been shooting in one of the main central streets and a square housing the central bank. There were also reports of tanks in a southwestern suburb and clashes involving helicopters in the north and northeast of the city. The British Foreign Secretary William Hague has said more sanctions would be enforced against Iran if no progress is achieved on Tehran's nuclear programme. Iran denies Western accusations of a covert agenda to develop a nuclear weapon, insisting it wants to stockpile enriched uranium solely to generate more electricity for a rapidly growing population. Indian fishermen who survived a gun attack by a US Navy boat off the coast of the United Arab Emirates have disputed claims by the US that they had ignored warnings to steer clear of the vessel. One Indian was killed and three others injured when the USNS Rappahannock, a refueling ship, fired on the fishing vessel. And the European Commission, which has controls of one of the world's largest science budgets, has backed calls for free access to publicly funded research in a move that could force a major change in the business model for publishers. The Commission said that open access will be a general principle applied to grants awarded through the €80 billion Horizon 2020 programme for research and innovation. And those are the headlines here at Monocle 24.
Thanks very much for that, James. It is just 19:34 in Zurich, 13:34 if you are listening in Ottawa. Well, we're now, it's time to maybe do a bit of a retail tour. And there's been a bit of retail in yesterday's program, but also we'll be sticking with the topic as well tomorrow as well. I was pointing out to you, Andrew, a little bit earlier today, Von Bedorf, a store which has long been true to my heart for a variety of reasons, aside from an absolutely stunning international lineup of products. I think the great thing is when you go into, I think, as you sort of wrote and read in the intro of the program, I think we're really talking about perhaps one of the best retail outlets in the world if you want to buy great design. And they've got a great international lineup, but also there's always a sort of wonderful theme of Swissness, which is also running through the store. Also amazing that here's a retail outlet, which is also 80 years old, 80 plus years old, which is quite something. And I'm pleased to say that we have the owner, Felix Messmer, is in studio. Welcome.
Hello.
I wanted to kick off and maybe ask you about the Swiss consumer when it comes to design. The one thing I notice when you go into most Swiss households, not all the time, Swiss companies, there still seems to be a strong investment in design and buying quality pieces. I think we've seen in many markets around the world, people buy design, but they're not buying the real brand. It might look like something, it's not the real deal. You've built up a business of not just representing the godfathers of a great Swiss design, but also a series of course, international brands as well. Tell me about the Swiss consumer and this commitment to buying quality.
Well, of course, we don't only have Swiss consumers in our store. We have an international consumer. Zurich is today not only a Swiss city, as we heard before. I think one of the reasons is the architecture we have here in Switzerland. I think we have a very high quality of building houses and also office buildings. And this, of course, gives the consumer a certain sense of quality for design sourced by the architects. And lines up to the furnitures, which they would like to have there. And sustainability today is a subject which helps our industry. So, people want to invest their money into something they will also like to have tomorrow or the day after tomorrow. Short-term thinking is not very popular anymore. And this also, of course, has an impact on the furniture they buy.
I can ask you, the company traces its roots all the way back to the 1930s. Is there a kind of a line that runs through the business all that time? Has it always promoted the best design, the best contemporary design around?
Yeah, the reason why Wombedorf exists was the Bauhaus situation back in the 30s, where this. By that time, young architects like Corbusier, Aalto, or Mies van der Rohe, they designed new furniture for their new type of houses. And the Wombedorf founders, they picked up that idea and said we should produce these furnitures industrially and make it open to the public. That was the reason why Wombedorf was founded as a modern furniture publisher. This was the main idea. Mm. And we always worked together with these architects and these designers, and so it came up to the situation where we had a lot of classics in our assortment, and that's what we are still doing today, because the story doesn't end somewhere. The classics, they were designed in the 30s and the 40s and the 50s, and they are also designed today. And we just last year took up a new line, which is from today, contemporary, and we are convinced that will be a classic in 10 years.
I wanted to go back to something we were talking to Mr. Schwartz about a little bit earlier, and that was, you know, that notion of maybe buying Swiss, not necessarily from a protectionist point of view, but also supporting the home team. So, you know, one of the brands that you stock, I mean, globally well known, let's say USM Holler, I mean, famous for its chrome frames, and of course its, you know, its multitude of different, you know, colored metal panels. But just, you know, such a strict, smart, clever system, you know, never really changing, and this is a constant in Swiss households. And of course, when you go into, it seems like almost like most Swiss companies, is that a status piece when you look at this? Oh, I can almost afford, or I've got the good design sense to buy this. Is it an investment in sustainability? I'm wondering sort of what the friction is between having an icon piece and something which is going to last versus, yeah, I mean, maybe just, I don't want to say showing off because it's not showing off, but more status.
So I don't think that USM Holler is a particular status, because end of the day, it's the cheapest furniture you can buy, because it can be used for 20, 30, 40 years. It's in 3 years, we have 50th anniversary.
Only in Switzerland would you hear that, but anyway, never mind.
And if you compare with other programs you have to replace every 10 years, it's really not expensive. The main reason why it's very famous is because you can always adjust it to new needs. I mean, the office situation between 60s and today changed completely. We have today totally different technical background than we had back in the 60s. And this USM Holler could always be adapted to the new situation. And big companies which work with that, they never have to throw away any furniture. They can always reuse the existing parts and build new furniture for the new needs. And I think this is a mentality which in Switzerland is typical. You invest into something which lasts forever. And this probably is one of the reasons why this program is very successful, especially in companies. I mean, in no other country, so many companies are equipped with USM Holler than in Switzerland. We have companies with thousands of workplaces with USM Holler. And I think in other countries, this is not yet the case, but there is a lot of potential for this company.
And what's amazing is that the production is also just down the road as well.
It's in Switzerland, yeah. And it's most of the parts, only very little parts. I think about 5% of the parts are not sourced in Switzerland, yeah.
Can I ask you, when you look at, you know, across the borders, places like Italy, is there a very different retail market there, do you think? Is there something particularly Swiss about the way that you retail and the kinds of people that come to you? I wondered if, you know, that you found that you've got generations of people, for example, who had shopped with you at Wombedorf, who now their kids are coming back to you, for example.
Well, I think I can only speak for my company. I cannot speak for general furniture industry in Switzerland. We are in the center of Zurich, and Zurich is a reformed city, so we are very much slim how we present ourselves. In other countries, there's more maybe louder music and different kind of furniture in there. So, and we are very we stick to our line since a lot of years, since decades. And that's maybe a little bit of difference. But I think in Germany and countries which are more alike, a little bit like Switzerland, you find similar stores which have similar concepts behind. Mm. But of course, they don't have the history we have, yeah.
And with that history, this is a company which you bought quite recently. In the grand scheme of things, when you look at sort of the lineage of it, does Von Bedorf continue to exist as just one branch, or will we see one in Geneva or maybe in Tokyo or London at some point?
Well, this is a very good question. My board of directors ask me sometimes the same question. For the moment, we stick to the one store we have. We have an additional store in another small city, which is a franchise store. And we just founded last year a sister company, which is producing, again, their own furniture. We have there the designs of Max Bill. We have the rights to produce that worldwide. We have already customers in the States and in Japan. So that is then dealers who buy from us. And we are sole importer for Bassam Fellows from the United States. So this is one of the extensions we do with the company for the moment. And what the future will bring, we don't know today.
Great. Felix Messer from Von Bedorf here in Zurich. Thank you very much. You're listening to Midori House. We're back in a moment.
At one of the world's busiest seaports, Laem Chabang, it's easy to see why Thailand is such a dynamic trading hub. With our entrepreneurial, multi-skilled workforce, we're busy making sure vital goods get to market on time, every time. It's this hands-on approach that's made us the globe's fifth largest container shipping nation. But it's not only goods we're exporting. Our pop music is a big hit too. To find out more, visit modern-thailand.com.
The Olympics are coming to London. And to Monocle 24. From the 27th of July and throughout the Games, we'll be going faster, higher and stronger, bringing some of the icons of the Games into Midori House, as well as taking Midori House out on the road with a series of special shows from across the city. Monocle 24, keeping a sporting eye and an ear on the Olympics.
...1945 here in Zurich, 1845 in London. You are listening to Midori House with Tyler Brulé and Andrew Tuck. Time for another song, Andrew?
Yes, Swiss again, I hope.
Yeah, who do you have for us now?
Well, I think we're going to have somebody who actually came on to one of our Monocle live sessions once when we did the summer series, I think it was. Or was it the winter series? Winter series.
I think it could have been. I think it was summer series.
Okay.
Doesn't matter.
Well, she's called Heidi Happy. And this is Who You Are by Zwicker, featuring the lovely Heidi Happy.
Getting ready for the night, where the nicest dress you are. Who you are, I wonder who you are, who you are.
And that was Who You Are by Zwicker featuring Heidi Happy, and you're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
You are. Are you hungry, Andrew?
I'm very snacky. I need
You're snacky?
Yeah, I need something snacky.
I like that
snacky
word. We should probably then go to IM Viaduct. Have you been over to IM Viaduct?
Yes, I went actually when I was here in the winter time, about 6 months ago. And it's an amazing kind of setup, isn't it? It's kind of the rail arches that have been turned into this extraordinary food market.
You know, so many cities have tried to figure out what they should do with the rail viaducts. And yeah, London being a good example, they're often, you know, car repair joints and actually nothing more advanced than that. And it's amazing what they've done here in Zurich. They've completely reinvented the whole concept. You know, great sort of, you know, public, well, foot transport sort of running above, and then this wonderful food hall underneath. Our team went to check out what was on offer, and here's what they found.
My name is Hans Peter. I'm from Zurich here. We are here in a wine store. The name of the wine store is Südhang. That means this is the south side. We have different wines here from different countries. We prefer the wine here from France. We have different regions there. Fougères, South France, Corbière Minervois, a selection of Beaujolais, and the Valley of Loire. It's very famous. Then the other strong side from us is the Spanish wines. Ribera del Duero is very famous, Rioja, then the Costa Brava in the north of Barcelona. Here is Monsant and a small selection of Utiarequena near from Valencia. I'm here 3 months. But I've been a wine profi. I work with wine 20 years.
My name is Rafael Käser. I'm the son of Rudy Käser, who started all this business. We are a small family business who is growing their own vegetables and fruits, and is selling as well fruits and vegetables from other countries, like special artichokes or fruits from everywhere around the world. Just good stuff. We have mainly local products, so when we, so let's say in summertime now, we have about 95% from Aargau, so that's about 30 minutes from here, and only about 5% from other regions in Switzerland. We sell Swiss whiskey, we sell the fruit schnapps we produce since about 20 years, and in 1999 we started producing Swiss whiskey. And since about 2003, 2004, we produce Swiss whiskey in an original Scottish pot still, and we produce about 8 to 10,000 liters a year. At the moment, we sell mainly in Switzerland, about 70%, and 20% in Germany and 10% in Holland. But now we're starting to send our whiskies to England as well, because one retailer came and said, we would like to sell your whiskies. It's actually masterofmalt.com, like this shop. It's a really good shop as well. So yeah, they start to sell our whiskies, and it gets all really exciting.
And that was our team reporting from IM Viaduct here in Zurich.
And finally tonight, we've talked economics, food, coffee and design. So let's get a taste of the trends to look forward to this year.
Freck Froböse is a researcher at the GDI, the Gottlieb Duttweiler Institute, just outside of Zurich, a non-profit organisation that does research in retail and consumer behaviour, which Freck specialises in, along with lifestyle trends, mobility and tourism. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
I guess I've had the good fortune to visit your wonderful facility, and I spoke there once, and it's incredible sort of the body of work that comes out of there. What is the Institute looking at the moment in terms of significant trends within Switzerland or on a broader level?
Yeah, there's a number of reports that have recently come out. For example, our infamous Consumer Value Monitor, which is a study that we do every 2 years about food trends in Switzerland and how values are changing with regards to food that people buy and eat. And another example that I have conducted myself, a study about homes, which I was very curious to hear your previous interview about.
And tell us, what are the key findings? Let's do food first before we look at the home.
Well, food, our main finding was that people continue to be rather disappointed by the offer that is available in the supermarkets, in the sense that people want a food that comes from here, that is regional, that is also organically produced, and that the big retailers in Switzerland fail to deliver the quality of food that the people want. With regard to a special also development between the study that we did 2 years ago and today, is that even the outlook that people have towards the future remains skeptical. People just don't think that the retailers that are in the market today are ever going to try and deliver.
It always seems extraordinary when you're an outsider, because you go into a Swiss supermarket and in fact the offer is so much stronger than you'd find in any other supermarket probably in Europe. And
it's one of these Swiss problems.
Yeah, it's another one of these things where, in fact, I think that Swiss supermarkets are pretty good at doing regional food in comparison to what you'd see in other supermarkets around the world. Do you think that Swiss consumers are a bit spoiled, maybe?
They're definitely a bit spoiled, but they also know very well what's going on. So if we analyze that there's people, for example, these small neighborhood communities that are starting up to develop also in Switzerland, where people cook for each other, or where there's urban farming going on, where people know exactly where the food comes from. So they still don't see that quality of knowledge and consciousness in the food that they find in the supermarket. And another thing that is quite important in Switzerland at the moment is the arrival of discounter supermarket chains from elsewhere. So the development that people are seeing is that, for example, the discourse about money and prices of food has actually taken over the discourse about the quality. Obviously, all of this is a little bit of a luxury problem in the sense that the quality of food is definitely fine. At the same time, the development that it's taking at the moment is not towards the better.
Okay, let's move from the refrigerator to the wider home. What were the home trends that you found when you solicited and did your research?
Yeah, I was very very curious to hear your conversation with regards to the differences between the Swiss consumer and consumers elsewhere, because the Swiss consumer also changed over time, right? It's not as uniform as we might often believe, although there is a strong design tradition in Switzerland, in the sense that furniture used to be something completely fixed to the house, right? Up to the mid 19th century, it was never changed. People grew up knowing the furniture that they also knew when they were 60, 70. They never moved house much, and the furniture was just stable. Then with the arrival of modernism, that changed completely and everything became mobile. And today we actually see a returning to the more stable kind, in the sense that even people, not only the customer of shops like Wohnbedarf, want the USL shelf, but also people who normally wouldn't be the clientele of such a shop, but young students who are starting to just furnish their first home, instead of going to a cheaper shop and like exchanging their furniture after 5 or 10 years, they also now settle for something permanent.
And do you think that that's because the economy here has been less affected by kind of ups and downs in the global economy? Because I think often in other countries you see people suddenly going for something stable and sturdy because the economy is doing badly, and then suddenly when things are going well again, they'll go for something a bit more fashion prone. Is that just a general trend here?
The tradition of GDI is to look at counter trends in opposition to mega trends. So if we say that, obviously, how to phrase this, like since Switzerland is already doing very well, it's already very stable, then suddenly the unconventional, the adventurous becomes chic. Okay. Becomes trendy, right? Like these things, they're not so divided. It's not like, there's another country in crisis, then the stable becomes the trend. In Switzerland, since things are very stable, maybe the adventurous, maybe the unstable become the trend. Mm. Or another example that I can give in the same context is that we did another study about tourism and why people would go to, or what would the experience of people be who go hiking in the mountains in New Zealand, with in contrast to those people hiking in the mountains in Switzerland, where all the pathways are very well labeled, where you never get lost, where you can find a hut in the middle of the Alps anytime you want, where probably the Swiss railway takes you there without any problem. If it has a delay of more than 5 minutes, it will tell you in advance. And in New Zealand, where hiking is really an adventure, So we analyzed the photos that people uploaded on places like Facebook and other image websites. And what we found is that New Zealand was very adventurous. People talked about the discovery they did, the people they met. In Switzerland, everybody said it's very picturesque. They took the same pictures that they already knew on postcards. All of this just to say is that like security is not just a trend in itself, but it also provokes the opposite.
Excellent. Fark Fibbers from the GDI, the Gottlieb Duttweiler Institute. Thank you very much for that.
Thank you.
We are just about out of time. Today's show is produced by Daniel Giacopelli. Our researchers are Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Menon Spindler. Our studio manager back in London, Toby Hammond, and Gregor Bauchmann here in Zurich. At 2200, Andrew Muller and Emma Nelson are back with the Monocle Daily. But for all of us here in Zurich, it's goodbye from me, Tyler Brulé.
And me, Andrew Tuck.
And in about 1 minute's time, we're back with the news.